Welcome to Destiny. Now here's your host, Cliff Dunning.
Hey, hey, it's March. Yeah, it's March 1st. And I hope you're doing well. I hope wherever you're listening, it is cozy. You know, you could be in your car. I have people that email me and go, Cliff, you know, I drive a truck and I listen to you on my various drives. And I'm like, great. I dig it. Some, you know, if you could really go back, I think there's over 500 programs. You can go back to 2014 when I used earbuds and an iPhone mic as my recording equipment. That's how limited I was. I was kind of playing around a little bit way back then. And I was producing other people's shows. And so I launched Earth Ancients and I launched Earth Ancients first as kind of a quirky idea. And I'm serious about ancient civilizations. I think, you know, if you listen to that show regularly, you know that I question history. I question the current interpretation of history. Destiny arose out of my background as a conference producer for Whole Life Expo. San Francisco has always been the epicenter for weird, odd consciousness, drugs, new ways of living, new ways of thought. And so I was the program director for the biggest expo or conference having to do with all those kinds of things called Whole Life Expo. And so this was way before the power of the podcast, really before the internet was really functioning to the level it functions now with all these apps and programs and God, now it's artificial intelligence. Have you guys been listening and seeing and reading some of the artificial intelligence? I played with it recently and told it to write a short synopsis on ancient history. And I posted it on the Facebook page. I was shocked. Now, this is the real freakness about artificial intelligence. It takes contemporary thought and turns it into language. Or I've seen it now where you can get an artificial voice to read back what it comprehends or wrote. That's the huge problem with AI. Contemporary, orthodox thinking. It's like a Wikipedia. Everyone thinks Wikipedia is great. Wikipedia is very orthodox in its analysis and its look at theories, hypothesis, and it's very orthodox. And I find them putting down and criticizing people like John Anthony West, Graham Hancock, Robert Schoch. They get their little digs in. It's like I was reading today about Mars, and there's this one guy out there. His name is James Oberg. He was a consultant for NASA for years. He is now their barking dog. When anybody says anything and talks about anomalous discoveries on the moon, on Mars, or any other planets, he pops up because he doesn't want you to think anything anyway out of the box. If you begin thinking out of the box and going, wait a minute, this looks like ruins on Mars. Or wait a minute, the rover on the moon picked up what looks like some kind of a building. Wait a minute, wait. No, he'll jump on right now going, oh, it's a trick of light. It is flares. It is the planet, the sun reflecting. He goes out of his way. And the guy is a complete joke. He's become a joke. And I'll tell you why. You know, and I continue to support anomalies on Mars. I'm an anomalist. An anomalist, someone who has a special interest in exceptional cases. Well, things that appear perhaps to be unusual. That's an anomalous, and that's what I feast on that kind of material. I feast on that data. I mean, look, I'm a trained observer. I'm an illustrator. I was trained as an illustrator. I'm an amateur archaeologist. I went to school, actually. I was going to be an anthropologist. You might wonder, hey, Cliff, why are you so interested in ancient history? Well, I was going to be an anthropologist, but I was so bored. I mean, I barely got through college. I was a terrible student. You know what? I haven't told this to anybody. I got a scholarship out of high school. My grades were terrible. I didn't care. I was rebelling against my father. There you go. My dad passed away many years ago, so this won't come back to haunt me. My father was a teacher. He was a professor. He was a college professor. He was a high school teacher. And I rebelled big time. He was oh my God, talk about orthodoxy. So I rebelled. But I was fairly talented as a high school student. Got a scholarship to the Academy of Art College in San Francisco. After a year or two there, I transferred to the University of Long Beach in Southern California. And I studied illustration, and I studied animation. Oh God, that's a whole program right there, animation. So I've always been kind of a maverick or an anomalous. And so that's how I became a program director for Whole Life Expo. And so Destiny, God, that's kind of I'm spending a lot of time going in a big circle. Destiny came out because I wanted to express more, and I knew there was a huge, huge database of up-and-coming, unique authors, research investigators, and even scientists in this field of consciousness, metaphysics. I mean, listen to Destiny. I have more content coming out of Destiny than I have Earth Ancients. And I love Earth Ancients. My book is coming along great. You're going to love it, you guys. The Mayan Controversy. And I've already talked to people like Dr. Ed Barnhart. He agrees with me. on my point. So we'll have to go on that later. But so Destiny came out of my frustration, my wanting to bring up consciousness, to bring up the topics that I was promoting as a program director in this massive international conference called the Whole Life Expo. So there you go. That's where that came from. And I really dig podcasting. I really enjoy. I hope you're enjoying these programs too. For the most part, the ratings I get on iTunes are very positive. And by the way, I would really appreciate it if you got onto iTunes and said, hey, Cliff, great job. We love it. Or Cliff, we like it, but, you know, hey, I've promised not to be political anymore. I don't. I'm not political. And I understand why some people have a problem with that. But leave a review on iTunes. It would help. It would help me know that I'm doing a good job. So I'm doing something that you like, you know, and a lot of this is my interest. You know, we get Ruth on here, we get Mark, and we get some of the people that we have on, like Bruce Fenton in London, or Jin Deo, who's an archaeologist in Vermont. I hear from them. You know, I do want to hear from them, and I do want to hear from you. And that's another point. If you are interested in a specific subject, send me an email. My email is earthancients4u@gmail.com, and go, hey, Cliff, I've been listening to this person, or I read this book. I'd love to see him on your program. Because we're looking at tons of people. We book 60 to 90 days in advance. That's how much material we have. And it's always changing. It's always fun. And I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. welcome to podcasting. And that's my story in a nutshell. Hey, the program today is on magic. And when I say magic, the author, he's actually a philosopher. He's a guy named Carl Abramson. He is from France. And he wrote a book called Source Magic, The Origins of Art, Science, and Culture. And what makes this book fascinating is that he gets into the shamanistic aspects of evolution. And this is something that I'm always curious about. We've heard it from Graham. We've heard it from other people. Is that how have we evolved consciously? Is it simply that we took mushrooms? That we took mind-altering plant medicines, and through our visions, we moved to the next level? Is it panspermia? Now, remember panspermia. Wick Ramsey's and Milton and others. Is evolution placed upon us through cellular matter that is being sent to us by some extremely old, ancient, billion-year-old civilization? Is our evolution manipulated? Do we have free will? These are questions that a lot of cosmologists, physicists, quantum physicists are thinking about right now. What is our, how do we evolve? Is it natural selection where a branch of Homo sapiens sapien dies off? Are we evolving right now? Is there a future hominin that we should start looking at? And so the program today is magic, but magic in the form of so much more than making your life better, finding the love of your life, making money, hexing people. It's more about visioning. It's about prophecy. It's about metaphysics. And that's two things that we haven't talked enough about, which is metaphysical reality versus magical reality. They're kind of tied up together. Metaphysics is that you manifest what you want. Some people say you create your own reality. And there's a lot of off-world types that say that. There's a lot of channeled entities that say that. I used to follow an entity called Lazarus, and he was like huge on you create your reality. And he had a whole bunch of tapes and a bunch of lessons. The issue is you can be as successful as you want by manipulating and creating your own reality. The problem is we got our past as children and how we were raised, the influences in our world. And some people are like, I don't believe that crap. You don't create your own reality. It happens to you. Well, unfortunately, if that's your attitude, you're in trouble, because having it happen to you means that you don't have free will, that it's just a day after day. You wake up, 9-to-5 existence, you go to bed, you wake up again. And that is not a way to live. I of the belief, and you know, if you follow Destiny, you know, we got the vision boards where you're visioning how you want your life to go. How you want this month to go? How you want this year to go? I finished my vision board late this year. I finished it in late January. So when we had Joyce on, Joyce Schwartz, in the beginning of January, talking about our vision board, I finished mine later because I just got too busy. Just didn't have any time. So, but that is a key. That's a manifestation. So I believe, as a metaphysician, that we do create it. And it's important that we clear out the crap, the negativity, the depression, the influences that are not positive in our life, and we try to be as positive as possible, and we program. The vision board is one way to program. You have all your images of what you want, how you want it to come out, and so forth and so on, and you look at that every day, a couple times a day, and you think about it, and hopefully that manifests into something in your reality. So really in the metaphysics today, kind of strangely. So the program today is Source Magic, The Origins of Art, Science, and Culture. And my guest is Carl Abramson. Interpreting modern and ancient occult and magic practices is a real big challenge. We've had a number of people on the program who have been using magic, who interpret magic. But my guest today actually delves in. I would call this new work shamanistic in many ways. My guest today is Carl Abramson. He is a writer, publisher. He calls himself a magico anthropologist. We're going to ask him about that in a minute. He's a filmmaker and also a photographer. He's a prolific author. And the book we're talking about today is called Source Magic, The Origin of Art, Science, and Culture. And it's important to have authors like Carl on the program because I believe magic and the occult, and even you can get in even to psychedelics today, is a form of personal evolution, social evolution. This is where we begin to see the bits and pieces of what is coming, what has happened, what has passed, what is going on now, and what the future holds for us. So, Carl, welcome to Destiny. Great to have you on the program.
Thank you very much. It's very, very nice to be here.
Would you call yourself a modern day shaman?
Wow, that's a very good question.
I would say yes, Carl. I mean, without saying, Carl's taken ayahuasca today, and he has a new insight on what's going on. No, I would say that you and in this new book, you're called Source Magic. You're actually presenting essays and articles that you've written, and I get this sense that you're kind of dipping in and out of the past and the future. So what do you say?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that the description could absolutely be correct in the sense that and this obsession I have, and I've had for a long time, of sort of taking in stuff that I find very, very interesting, and then in a way reformulating it or repackaging it, whatever, and present it to new people, for instance, new generations or new networks. And it's worked really well, because I think I'm good at that. However, on a personal level, in all of my magical, you know, occult explorations and the various schools and traditions and things, you come to a point when you realize that they're pretty much all the same. They're just packaged in different ways. But as you said before, it's all about personal transformation, evolution, this kind of thing. And when you look at these things throughout history, then you realize that, okay, so what is it really about? Well, it's about empowerment, but it's also about insight. You have to have insight into, you know, deeper facets, deeper layers of your psyche and yourself. How did people way back when acquire this? Well, we can get some clues from watching indigenous cultures that exist, and also archaeology and stuff like that. And we have archetype or gestalt of the shaman, who is basically someone who goes, who transcends the rational mind, goes into a different mind frame, and comes back to him or herself, or to the little tribe, or to the community with new information. And then you can say, what kind of information is that? And how can we validate that? How can we sort of know that it's the truth, etc.? But those rational validation requirements, they're pretty new. We call them empirical attitudes, empirical methods, etc.
Yeah.
But when it was culturally integrated to have this kind of special person, almost like a profession or a calling, to go on these journeys, you know, that was a different thing. People trusted those people as key people in the community for the survival of the community. Yeah. And the problems only arise much, much later when the communities are too big and you have these things called greater philosophies or religions, and you have priests that are the only ones allowed to sort of interpret the information that might not be original, genuine information coming from personal trips anymore. It could just be something written in a book, the big, you know, serious thing that you have to worship and obey. And then it's already become something else. And then, of course, there are other aspects of the shamanic gestalt. You know, you have the creative aspect, you have the artistic aspect, you have the what you call the proto-scientific aspect, finding new things out. And I believe that since, like our genetics in general, we have our instincts, our survival instinct, and the abilities that, you know, we inherit from previous generations, I believe that what I call magic is basically a part of our survival instinct. We have inherited and carry on genetically this thing of needing to transcend, needing to go beyond the rational mind to find like a direct link to knowledge. You know, and it's kind of a hard usually for empirical minds to say that, you know, this is not pure epistemology. Knowledge needs to be verified, la-da-da, and all of these sort of logical, Western logical mind frames. And I usually reply then that, you know, the very foundation of empiricism, of the empirical method, is actually something incredibly irrational. And that's speculation.
Are you all saying the scientific method isn't valid anymore? have a problem with that all the time, and I totally know what you're saying. Go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think it, of course it is. But the foundation of the empiricism is speculation. You know, it always begins with a kooky idea. Some scientist says, what if? You know, what if I mix and match these things? What will happen then? And most of the time, it will fail. And they won't know that until they've tried it empirically. But still, the very foundation of the method is irrational speculation. So there you have it in so many facets of human life and human endeavor, the need to go beyond the rational mind. And so I have done that. I have been through, you know, shamanic journeys and psychedelic journeys and been on this magical trip for well over 30 years. And it's filled my life with a lot of joy and excitement and meaning. So in a sense, getting back to answering your question, I probably would say that I'm a shaman of sorts. This personal vocation that I have to go beyond, but also in a way to present material that I have perhaps acquired or reinterpreted or had new insights about, connecting the dots basically and presenting it to my little community. So in that sense, yes.
Yeah, I totally see you as an interpreter of the old wisdoms, the ancient magic of our ancestors, and you know, some of the new thought providers, and they're not too new, people like Carl Jung and Rudolf Steiner and these other people who wrote about other dimensions, other realities of perception. And I think that, especially in the Western culture, we are too locked into immediate sensibilities and not looking at our ancestors. And I'd like to talk a little bit now about how you interpret magic and if you're using magic at any state. And within that, I'm really curious to know what your definition of magic is, because we can get into love potions, we can get into prophecy, we can get into a whole different subdivision or definition of magic. So I'm giving you a lot to define there, but take it one step at a time there.
Yeah. No, I think being a magical anthropologist and sort of writing about these things and phenomena and looking at them from various perspectives, I see that it's magic is something so incredibly central to human existence on an individual level and on a cultural level. And I mean that globally in all different kinds of cultures, it's there. Then, of course, the following question that you basically just asked, you know, what is it? You know, how do you define it? And I think that there have been many, many brave attempts at defining what magic is. And I guess mostly the most well-known one in the, at least in the occult community, from the 20th century was Aleister Crowley's definition. He said that the, you know, magic is the science and art of causing change to occur in conformity with will. You know, mm-hmm. So they have a philosophy of will that he had, I wouldn't say appropriated, that he developed from Nietzsche, of course, and from Schopenhauer before him, and, you know, many others also. That's interesting, because then you have, then basically anything is magic that sort of manifests your will. However, I believe that we need to have this sort of extra level, this extra layer of, you know, the fantastic, the amazing, the transcendental, the mind-boggling or the mind-bending. And I have given this so much thought and realizing that there are so many different definitions culturally, you know, from different eras, that I came up with something that is, that it's basically a mind frame. Magic is a mind frame that allows for all the different definitions of it to pass through or coexist in a way, meaning you can have the rational, crass, stripped one that Crowley had, that anything that manifests my will is magic. Or you could have the super trippy, fantastic, fireworks, psychedelic thing. And then you could have the mundane one, which is like when two people are talking about a movie, for instance, and they say, whoa, that was so magical. You know, is that yeah. That's a definition that is so common, and people know basically what it means. It means something that is out of the ordinary. And I believe that aspect has to be in there, something that is simply beyond the normal, beyond the rational. And then, of course, you can look at it historically and see what it has been in implementation or application. It's been healing. It's been learning about the universe, sort of like a proto-astronomy or, you know, astrology, healing arts, early medicine, alchemy, early chemistry, you know, all of these things that we know as empirical science that have helped us so much and created wonderful technologies, they all have their roots somewhere. And usually it's in some kind of occult soil that has maybe been heretical, maybe it's been banned, maybe it's been too threatening to the powers that be, etc. That's also interesting. And that's a process I call occulturation, where something goes from the occult and into the mainstream and creates either an occulture or a real culture, a real mainstream culture. So in part, it's how we perceive and experience things. Wow, it's magical. But it's also what we do in life that transcends the norms. That is something that could be said to be magical because it changes things. That's something that is necessary in the equation. There needs to be a transcendence in the same sense from something old into something new, the creation of something new. And then culturally, how this has, you know, panned out or existed, it's basically when it's culturally approved, you know, then people can dance together, get ecstatic. We still do that in our culture, and, you know, even with getting drunk and stupid every weekend, because we have that need to transcend, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that maybe it's better to you know, smoke a joint than get plastered by alcohol, you know, because at least you can giggle, you know, and appreciate good music.
Yeah, or shift the awareness rather than getting
that
numb.
Too.
Totally
that
numb.
Too. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So I think, but that's another inherent need that we have, you know, to have this regular kind of touch with ecstasy. And I'm not talking about the drug, but this kind of ecstatic mind frame, alone or together to feel that community in ways that is not simply a dialogue. It's not simply rational, but you know, something else. And I think I don't know. It's just that wherever you look, I mean, these days we can see that thematically there's a lot of magic around in shows, in streaming TV series, in movies, in books, you know, and then the question, of course, is why is this? You know, is it just crass exploitation of something that people are interested in? But I think it's more than that right now, because it goes over the entire spectrum. You have it in sort of cheap mainstream culture, and you have it in highbrow settings with, you know, esoteric painters that are discussed and have huge shows that are very popular, like the Swedish painter Hilma af Klint I mean, she's like a superstar, and in her time no one even knew that she existed, you know. That's her show at the Guggenheim. It's the most popular they've ever had. You know, that's just incredible. And she was just an old Swedish lady who communicated with spirits, and they told her what to paint, basically. And she did it, and she was amazing. And it was way, way, way ahead of her of the time, you know, ahead of the curve. But still, we have the highbrow stuff, and we have the lowbrow stuff. All of it in some way deals with magic or different, you know, states of mind, the transcendences. And I believe I have found at least one, you know, crucial, central answer to why that is. And again, it has to do with our survival instinct that we have within us, you know, even genetically.
So you're let me just interrupt you real quickly. Okay. So I want to get clear on this, that in your research, you're finding that a magical element is inherent in our species.
Yes. Yes. And I mean that both from the the Crowleyan definition we discussed, you know, manifestation of will. Will is very important, but there needs to be another dimension too that creates transcendence. That can be achieved on your own, but historically it has been achieved together. You know, it's not, you know, usually there's one shaman going on a trip, but for instance, in dancing and revelry and all these traditional things that we have in different parts of the world that you do together, that creates something out of the ordinary, trances, ecstatic shared communal experiences. That's basically one very, very important aspect of it. And again, to return to the survival instinct, I think that a magical appreciation and an insight and an awareness that magic actually exists within us is part of our survival instinct. And how this works, from my perspective, is that let's call it the Western empirical mind frame achieved a lot of great things, but the lifestyle that we have maintained around that mind frame of empiricism and, you know, using nature as a, pantry in a way that is will never be depleted, but it will be. And I think we have come to such a critical mass point in development of human culture that we need to reassess and see how can we do things differently. And then, you know, magic comes unlocking in our unconscious and says, whoa, these people are very interesting here in the jungle, or this historical tribe. Oh, wow. Maybe we shouldn't spray, you know, these poisonous chemicals on our vegetables, you know, just very basic things like that. And it has been going on for a long time. I would suspect, you know, this is pure speculation in my detective work, that it had something to do with kind of a shift. You know, some people call it the Age of Aquarius. Crowley called it the Aeon of Horus. You know, there are many things going on basically during the 20th century. There was a shift there that was necessary, because if we don't adhere to or listen to ourselves in that respect, then it's bye-bye. You know, we're going to be extinct. And it's unfathomable, because we're sitting here and you and I are talking to each other on two different continents in real time. And it's so amazing. We've achieved so much in terms of, you know, medicine. But at the same time, there is a brutal war again on European soil.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, global warming and all kinds of stuff, pandemics. You know, so how do we cope with these things? Well, you can go complete escapist and just watch another, binge watch another series on TV, or you could perhaps meditate and see, where does knowledge come from? You know, where can I learn more about myself and become a more, you know, active and happy and person who finds meaning in life? Well, it's very simple. Go to, you know, I wouldn't say go to the magic, that's too vague, but go to something that appeals to you on an intuitive level. And it's really important that you begin with yourself. Otherwise, you'll become like some cult member of something that will end up in disaster. Someone selling you something, quick fixes of this or that. The main thing is just to wake up, you know, on an individual level. And that's something that's been so dominant, predominant in many spiritual teachings, you know, Gurdjieff or Steiner, these things, that we're all asleep. And it feels to me, though, that we are waking up. And it's a kind of a rude awakening, a harsh awakening from a very sedate, technicolor, you know, dreamscape of carbohydrates and TV.
But when you say we're waking up, Carl, what do you, I mean, because we've had the New Age movement of the 60s and 70s. There's some that are speculating that we are moving into more of a internalized view of ourselves, but less interactions. What are you seeing?
I'm seeing that. And I'm seeing that as a, again, there is a wide spectrum of things offered in a way. And I think that's great, because not everybody is attracted to you know, Zen Buddhism, or this harsh, stern self-discipline, asceticism in a way. We are Western people. We like the senses. We like sensual stuff, perhaps too much, but, you know, but still we do. And I mean that it's absolutely possible to be completely transcendent while still enjoying the body, enjoying sensual stuff. There is no contradiction. There's only contradiction coming from people who have something to sell, to say that this, what we sell, is good, and that's what over there, that's just bad, stay away from that. And we can see that, you know, in very draconian ways over the centuries and millennia, even within, you know, monotheist cultures. But now I love this kind of spectrum. You can, you know, cock an eye on many of these things, saying that it's too vague, it's too fluffy, it's too pastel, it's too new agey. But it doesn't matter if it gives some people that kind of lift or, you know, wake up call that's needed, because essentially we are all in the same boat, and it's both good and bad. It's very bad if people don't wake up, because then they'll just, you know, weigh down the vehicle and the boat will sink probably. But it's also great if more people wake up, which they, according to me, can only do on an individual level. Yeah. And then they can see, you know, which direction will I go to find the others. And this kind of, this process for me is essentially magical. This awakening process and this looking at yourself in the mirror, in a way, and looking at life as not simply a passive journey, but as an active journey in which you can, if you're lucky, diligent, and determined, find something called meaning, that you find meaning in life. And I can't really define it in another way that's like better or more or clearer than that. For me, the epitome, or, you know, the highest states of all spiritual and, you know, magical schools and traditions, it's basically Jungian individuation. You know, you take yourself seriously, and you transform yourself into a higher version of yourself, a clearer, more defined, happy person. And why are we happy when we're like that? Well, it's because we feel that it's meaningful. You know, if you talk to people in general, many of them will say that some things in my life are meaningful, but most aren't, you know. And the challenge for a life, an individual life, would then be to, you know, create some meaning, find some meaning, create some meaning, refine some meaning, and enjoy it.
We're going to take a short commercial break, and we will return with Carl Abramson, speaking on his new book, Source Magic. We'll be right back. My guest today is author Carl Abramson. And Carl considers himself a magic anthropologist, someone who has studied various traditions throughout the world and has developed and written a new book called Source Magic. Talk a little bit about what you have discovered about the so-called hunters and gatherers or early civilizations and how they may have used magic. Obviously, there's no writing. We do have petroglyphs with images that look like shamanic journeying. And there's been a number of people who have written about those. But what have you discerned or perhaps discovered that was used as a form of magic?
I think that's a very good question also, because when we go backwards in time, backwards in culture, we come to a point when there are no written records, where there are very few archaeological finds, etc. So beyond that, of course, everything is speculation. I might have had inner experiences where I have come across, scenes or vistas or been given information from, different realms of consciousness where I've been told that this is the case and this is how they did it. Of course, that has no, real empirical meaning, or it's not like a piece of evidence that I'm trying to sell to other people. However, if you look at it from the perspective of likelihood, people way back when, they were very primitive. They had no time to, write sonnets and poems, and they had to fight, it's fight or flight. There's a woman, I'm going to fuck her, hope to procreate and avoid that lion over there.
Exactly.
So in that sense, it's very stripped, and that we know for a fact that those were the,
it's the harsh, the raw lifestyle.
Yeah,
absolutely. Very raw. Yeah.
Absolutely. And then, so also they knew nothing except how to survive on a day-to-day basis. Yeah. So, of course, darkness is terrifying. The stars are fascinating. You have the moon cycles, basically anything you can see. And then you have fire. Fire is very suggestive. So you have within a cave, like shadows and warmth and that safety kind of thing. The feeling of safety is connected to this visual, emotional experience that's almost like being in the movies, and the sounds of of nature in itself, where you have to learn, is that a threatening sound or is it a beautiful, friendly sound? So you have this sort of accumulation of raw data, which is processed in the context of pure survival. And then, of course, when you, for instance, that beautiful scene in Kubrick's 2001, when they find a tool or develop a tool, like a piece of stick that you can hit someone over the head or defend yourself, that's the beginning of real human evolution, survival based on skill, on creativity, on assessing your environment, of learning, taking in and deducting things, realizing that if I do like this, I will be eaten. If I do like this, I will kill them. And that in itself is inherently magical, because it's the beginning of a process that has made us who we are. And I think that for a long time, and here we're in speculative territory here, but for a long time, I think this accumulation of raw data and how to apply it was the magic then. And I'm thinking specifically, slightly later on, when you have slightly more advanced tribes and language, of course, is incredibly important, then you can share information. Here comes some people from another tribe and they can exchange information and say that we notice that it's like 28 whatevers between the full moon and the full moon, and there you have proto-science, and those things can be used in basically having a party, for instance, each full moon, because that's the brightest night. You can dance and feel safe. And then perhaps you'll connect with someone to have sex with, meaning more than just procreation. It could be involving emotional aspects, the development of emotional intelligence, for instance. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's a good question. We can't know. We can speculate. We can only know when we have real like evidence from those cultures. And then we can see, what are these? You know, and even that is based on likelihood. This was likely a drum, or this was likely a pot for cooking, you know?
Yeah.
And then gradually it becomes more like items that we feel affinity with, that we can, you know, deduct and say, that's obviously a pot. This is obviously a spear.
But isn't there artifacts that have a shamanic kind of overtone to them that we have discovered that we speculate could be magical tools or lead the shaman, for lack of a better word, or mm-hmm. leader of the group to work in other realms, either through mushrooms or through meditation or whatever. And that's kind of like the footprint for a magical experience.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, while we're on that subject, I think scientists only a couple of years ago came up with this, well-received theory that concerning the development of the human brain, you know, the size, but also how it's been used early on, and that there was actually a kind of a quantum leap, of course, not overnight, but over a fairly short period of time, where there were distinct changes, and that there were speculations, but very likely speculations, that it had to do with psilocybin, that they had been eating mushrooms,
yeah.
and that had helped, you know, the synapses to the synaptic speed to speed up, you know, right. The capacity to think, basically, and thereby make deductions and learn things. But again, you know, we can never be fully certain. But I do believe, seeing that this kind of, again, transcendental or psychedelic experience has been so central, even in the shamanic cultures that we do know, because they're still here. You know, people go to Latin America, to the Amazon and do the ayahuasca thing, or go to Central America and Southern US and go into the indigenous population and do, you know, peyote or these things. Not necessarily for, you know, the drug aspect, but to go on these trips that these people have been going on for absolutely thousands and thousands of years, because they have their own documentation, and it's been, you know, moved along orally and also written in written form and in other archaeological remains also. So from that we can deduce that it is a tradition much, much longer, and the inherent need to go beyond is very important for us. And I think it's, you know, today in our sphere, it's kind of depressing. You know, when we feel depressed, we get antidepressants. We don't get pro-ecstatic stuff. It's just something to nivellate and level things out, instead of going for a really good peak that will, you know, teach us something about ourselves.
Yeah.
But that's just how it is. And it's kind of sad. And I hope that will change. It seems that kids have always been rebels. They've always been trying, you know, they want to try things out. They want to go on these kinds of trips, whether it's journeying physically or internally. But the problem is, when you don't have a language and terminology or system to process these experiences in the main culture, then it becomes, you know, recreational. It's something you go tripping on a weekend, for instance, and then on Monday morning you're back in school or at work, you know, being your old self. Although this trip was amazing, it was so cosmic, it changed my life, you know. And then, of course, you look at your notes or scribbles from the trip, and it's like gobbledygook, you know.
But at the time, it was
so revealing. So if, for instance, after each of those experiences, like a coming of age ritual in a way, there were a terminology and someone experienced that could help you process the information or the experience, then that would be a different story. You know, then I think it would be a completely different ballgame. Today we are like the proverbial nails, you know, in the board, and if the nails, you know, stands out too much, there will be a hammer hammering down the nail so that everything is even and fine. It makes for a very efficient culture, but it also makes for a very depressed culture.
Yeah. Here in California, they're beginning, and actually in Oregon too, the state above us, they're beginning to use microdosing of DMT, LSD for various mental states, which I find quite refreshing. Now, unfortunately, we have to look at it on a federal level, which is nationwide. And this is where politics get involved. But you made a very good point of these psychedelics breaking people out of their depressing 9-to-5 existences. And I think that's a form of magic too, isn't it? When you have an altered level of consciousness, would you say?
Oh, absolutely. That's I think it's a very important part. And again, not just, you know, simply for recreational purposes that it's cool to, you know, chill out or whatever, but this thing that you can, in these days, learn more about yourself and in a very sort of deep and affecting way, that of course is magical because it has the power to transform you. And then, you know, the critics will say, and the draconian governments, whatever, they will say that, well, you know, this is not good because potentially this person will, you know, dissociate him or herself from, you know, the greater populace and move in a different direction. However, I don't buy that. I don't believe it's true. I don't think it's everyone's will to be a rebel, you know, to be a Tim Leary kind of figure, to, you know, drop out. I think a lot of people are genuinely always interested in, you know, developing themselves, evolving qualities they have, and remove negative things like in a therapeutic kind of way. I don't think I think most people are kind of, you know, this is safety in numbers. You know, you want to belong to a community, but you want to know and learn more about yourself. And when you talk to your neighbors, you find, well, it's exactly the same. You know, not everyone is an artist rebel, you know, some satanic figure who wants to break free and provoke the society. You know, those forces are very important also to provoke change, for instance. However, I think if magic and this sort of transcendental mind frame were more normalized, that it was okay to go on these trips and inner journeys, then I think people would be more harmonious, in the sense that you know, gnawing sense of frustration that you can't define would simply be gone, because it's okay to explore. It could be like completely, you know, weekend based and not disturb the workspace, you know. And I think people will be very interested in that, in levels that don't rock their boat. Most people don't want their boats to be rocked.
Hmm. Carl, who are the modern magicians? Who are the cultural magicians that you see influence? I say this to kind of reel you in a little bit, because if I were to reach out and say Elon Musk is a magician, in some ways his mindset is unique in pushing the envelope of what we can expect in the future with his SpaceX program.
Yeah.
Obviously Tesla is one of the best-selling electric cars in the world.
Yeah.
But is he a magician other than an influence? Is that the same spectrum? I'm interested in your definition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. But I think he is definitely not fully individuated. He is a trickster figure. And agent provocateur, as they say, you know, someone who likes to push the envelope. But, you know, there are many of those people who can, you know, make people, you know, pissed off or agitate communities, whatever. But he certainly has clout. He has something to show for his position. You know, it's kind of ballsy to pay the astronomical sum of whatever it was, $44 billion, to buy Twitter. You know, it's on the surface, it's insane, but it's also insane to go into space and that kind of thing. But that's where we are culturally and technologically. It's possible. It's possible to have a network like Twitter, and then a thing is only worth so much as someone is willing to pay for it. Mm-hmm. That's old commercial knowledge, you know. So I think that he's very, very interesting. I can, for me, it's like 50-50. One day I'm angry at him. One day I'm laughing with him, you know, because he is a clear-cut figure that I think is needed. There's always a need. Not a clown, but a trickster.
Yeah.
You know, someone who really goes off on a tangent in very creative ways, industrious ways, almost genius ways in a way, but at the same time seems to be no more, it's like watching a child in a way, a child playing. And I like it. I like it. So is he a magician? I would definitely say so, because he's intelligent and mature enough to have this sort of meta awareness of what's going on. Yet I do believe that he's not really in full control of it. And then there you have the childish thing. And for him, I think it would be counterproductive if he were. I think he should just stay how he is and, you know, do his thing. If you don't like him, then disconnect from Twitter. That's it. You know, don't buy a Tesla. As for other, you know, people in our culture, I would say the classic persona of the proxy, like for instance the rock star who goes into an ecstatic mind frame while performing, you know, that kind of godlike ecstasy on stage that can change people's mind frame when they look up at the stage, have this sort of quasi divine experience of watching someone on fire in a way. That's a kind of simple but necessary proxy figure. You know, someone takes on the ecstasy for the crowd in a way, and the crowd has a little bit of it, just enough to make them happy or find it interesting. I can't give any good examples, but I mean, in terms of classical examples, I guess, you know, Jim Morrison was one of those people.
So musicians who develop and...
Yeah, performers and artists who provide something that is so out of the ordinary that people cannot not be affected by it. And most people who flock there, they will go there like, you know, moths to the flame in a way to get a piece of that, to get a piece of that specific current.
Yeah, I think for me, it's asking you, you know, who are the modern magicians who... not only influence people, but help people transform. And of course, authors like yourself are hugely important. But for the growing, and this is an unfortunate situation, for the people who don't read, and there's a generation that just don't pick up books anymore, who look to social media, who are looking for an escape of reality, is it just the fact that we can offer a TikTok or we can offer a Facebook? I mean, it's kind of numbing in a way, but I'm just curious to get your sense of the new magic. What is the new magic and how do you define it and where is it?
Yeah. Again, super good question. And I just, it came while you were talking, old person, it wasn't that old, but you know, Steve Jobs was also those people, because I think Apple computers, they created a universe of their own in a way that a lot of people are using in fairly intuitive ways, much more so than the PC based thing, which is much more logical and regimented in a way in its approach. As for, you know, where the magic lies today, I would say, first of all, if we look at our culture, which is so fragmented, so technological, again, so depressed, I would say that even though it's nice and has a lot of potential, I think the magic for us, the biggest magic, lies where it's always bin, and that's in nature proper. And it, I'm saying, you know, you could have wonderful experiences even in a park, but if you can get out into nature proper, the beach, the sea, the ocean, mountains, or in a forest, or again, even in the park, to connect with the soil, connect with the, you know, chlorophyllic saturation, the photosynthetic process.
Right.
You know, it can, and with animals, hang out with animals, that kind of thing. That is magical because it's nonverbal, it's non-intellectual, it's irrational, but it fills you with such, I don't know, life force, or what, you know, the Asian people would call chi, you know, life force. And that, of course, is true for people all over the world, but maybe perhaps especially for us, you know, left brain, technological, hyper-rational, efficiency junkies, to basically just go into nature and don't bring technology. That's a challenge for a lot of people.
Oh my God.
I know for a fact
yeah.
that young people will say, well, I don't know if I dare go into this place without my phone. You know, what if something would happen? What if I would fall on the grass here?
Yeah.
So I think that's the thing. But also in terms of community, and if we look at our thing, I think a community building on social media can be very magical because it's so swift, it's immediate, and you can also find people so easily and just, you know, toss out some keywords, search for something. You get immediate feedback about where to find these things. And that has never happened before. You know, you, in the tiny, tiny little tribe, you could do it. You knew who had the speciality, you know, the capacity to do this or this weapon or this music, whatever it was. But in today's, you know, I don't know, if we're 8 billion people, you know, how can we know? Well, we can communicate online. And that, I think, is a magical potential, at least, to find the right people faster.
Yeah.
That's always been the same, you know, this thing of processing things faster is a key to surviving. It's always been like that.
Mm. Talk about a book you wrote called A Culture.
Mm-hmm.
I like the title, but what is it? What does that mean? And mm-hmm. what's the difference between that term and magic?
Well, they're certainly related. First of all, the book is very similar to the brand new one called that you talked about called Source Magic.
Source Magic.
In the sense that it's an anthology of essays and lectures and different things that I've written that are not, you know, completely quaquaversal, you know, going in different directions. But they are, there's a red thread there. And the red thread is always, for me, this word that you said, occulture, which is the title of a previous book. That, of course, is a mix of two words, occult and culture.
Yeah.
And we have seen it increasingly over these past decades, you know, how this has manifested, how it's sort of seeping into the mainstream culture. And that, again, is a process I call acculturation. And that term is kind of a twist of a phenomenon in sociology and also normal anthropology called acculturation. And that's when simply something goes into another culture or another level of culture. And basically, when I talk about occulture, I don't necessarily mean the hocus pocus stuff. You know, it doesn't have to do with alchemy. It doesn't have to do with primitive experimental science or calling on the gods and things like that. It could also simply be things, phenomena, people who are literally in the dark because they're forgotten. It could be composers or movie makers or authors that for some reason or other never reached the level of fame or infamy that they wanted in life. Mm. So they are kind of occult because in Latin, occult means hidden. They're hidden away. And when you move something by acculturation into culture, and then you create an occulture, that, again, doesn't necessarily have to be hocus pocus. It could be also moving something or shining the light on something that needs to be seen in this day and age in order to inspire people, in order to inform people. And I think one example of this in Source Magic. There's a chapter on the British TV series called The Prisoner. I don't know if you've seen that, but it's an incredibly good TV show. That it's kind of a fluke, you know. How yeah. the hell did this happen?
Are you talking about the old version of The Prisoner or the new one?
The old one, yeah.
Because the old one I watched as a kid, it was that balloon would kind
yeah,
of...
Rover, yeah.
Yeah, oh my God, what a great series. Yeah.
No,
yeah.
absolutely. And it's when you look at it again as an adult, and I've certainly done that many times,
yeah.
and it's just like, how did this happen? Well, there was sort of like a time slot open, yeah. I would say probably because of LSD in general culture, that so many crazy things managed to seep through, you know, censorship. And this TV series is not completely occult. It's not completely forgotten. It's kind of a cult series. However, I think that needs to be lifted up one notch to talk about the things that they were talking about in the TV series and how it came to be and why it's so popular still, not in the mainstream, but, you know, with this cult following. And is it still relevant today? And yes, it is. It's almost like it carries prescience, you know, the prescient oracular messages about a society that monitors its citizens. That they simply cannot escape. You know, we're all stuck in that little paranoid village.
Exactly. As we come to the close of our time, Carl, what kind of magic are you practicing? What are you doing to enhance your existence?
Mm-hmm. That's again, wonderful questions. I used to be involved in all kinds of experimental hocus pocus, meaning doing rituals, you know, calling in forces and, you know, from different traditions and magical schools and structures. And I looked at that as going to school in a way. You go through things, you have curricula that, you know, not all of them appeal to me, but I still want to go through it to learn. And when I sort of came out of that, still being very interested, but I felt that, you know, the greatest asset I have is me, you know, so I don't need anything external. And that's when my mind frame also changed from, you know, there's this thing called, well, I don't know what it's called, but you either ascribe outer forces, the powers to outer forces, like, you know, gods or angels or demons or whatever, or you go psychological and say, these are all just levels and facets of my own psyche. That's where I'm at right now. Whereas before, when I was younger, I think I did see some kind of, you know, objective truth to there being natural or supernatural forces that had, you know, character and identity, maybe even. What I do today, I am very blessed in the sense that I have, you know, I feel individuated. I work with what I love, you know, writing, and specifically writing about these things. So it's kind of a meta existence. Yeah. I write about magic and that is my magic, you know, and vice versa. So I would say that a lot of the magic, these feelings of transcendence, and also when I can say to myself or to my wife, because, you know, she has to listen to me, where I go, wow, this is so magical. And it could just be me connecting two banal dots in between two books, you know, that I'm writing about. But in terms of these extra things, we try to spend as much time as we can in nature proper. And even just, you know, walking the dog in the forest fills me with such joy and the energy. So I think a lot of it has to do also with how you allocate your energy in your system. You know, yeah. It's nice, you know, to watch some TV at times, but it's also very nice to be out in the forest. And then you sleep better.
No, so you make a very good point, and I've always felt the same way, that when you are in nature and you're walking, and you are shutting off the technology, you're reconnecting with Gaia, the Earth.
Yeah, yeah.
There is not only is there healing in that, there could be a form of magic in the rejuvenation that the body, the mind, and the spirit.
Absolutely. Yet.
In that practice of connecting with nature. So it's so interesting that you brought that back early, or you brought that up early in our discussion, is this force of Gaia, and yeah. how it's important to connect to, and as you call it, live a good life as a form of magic.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And I think that it's these things, they sound banal, but I do believe, and this is a very Western point of view, I do believe that you have to be, you know, good to yourself before you can really be good to others. And, you know, to go in all in on this sort of mass market altruism, you know, in the religious sense, it never really works out because, you know, there's still wars. There's still, you know, horrible things happening and oppression and, you know, draconian measures. However, you see right away when someone is happy, you see when an individual has found meaning in his or her life, you know, those people are not the shit disturbers. Those people are just happy, you know. So if more people, if more people could do that, and you know, they mind their own business, that's the best thing, you know. Yeah. If people need help, then they'll go help and they will get help back. It's really simple.
Fantastic. For those of you listening, I was just mentioning to Carl before we started that today, February 21st, is the release, the official release of this new book, Source Magic, The Origin of Art, Science, and Culture. And when I say release, that means that you can get it on Amazon. You can get it on your other digital book stores. And I would think, unless Carl says otherwise, it's probably stocked at the stores now too, right?
That's right. Yep, that's right.
Okay, so much success on that. How can people get a hold of you? Give us your website.
Yeah, the best place that takes you there and, you know, further and also to me is simply carlabrahamson.com. It's Carl with a C, Abrahamson with two S's, .com, carlabrahamson.com. Mm-hmm. And from there, you can go to the films I've made and the books I've written and many, many other things.
Yeah, for those of you listening, the website's excellent. It's got a lot of great material on Carl. Carl also has a Facebook page, a Twitter page, and an Instagram page. They look like they're very easy to get a hold of. His name spelled out is the best way to find him. Carl, as we conclude, what do you want people to get out of your book? I mean, it's a very, very fun read simply because it's articles, essays, and a mind trust or mind dump of you in different stages.
Yeah.
What are you hoping that people get from the book?
Well, there's the information in itself. I do want people to check out the things that I've become enthusiastic about, you know, whether it's an old TV series or experimental film or some heavy duty magic. But the main thing is that I hope that they will be inspired by my enthusiasm. Because I really love these things and I love conveying it to other people. And I hope that sort of is infectious in a way that they can take away that spirit and use it, you know, for their own, in their own research or in their own lives. Just I hope, a life affirming spirit. There's always stuff to discover and there's always, you know, there are always dots to connect. That's really what I'm about.
I love it. Fantastic. Hey, much success on this book. It was a pleasure speaking with you, and I'm going to dig in a little deeper. I only kind of glazed through it, but what I did read was fun. I enjoyed it.
Wonderful. Thank you. And, you know, until the next time.
I want to correct myself. I mentioned that Carl was from France, but he's actually from Sweden. He's in Stockholm, Sweden. And fun speaking with him. Very intelligent guy, very philosophical, and well-spoken on this topic. So I'm going to have him back in the future. I hope you enjoyed that interview. I thought it was fun. Hey, we are going to be in Mexico in November with Dr. Edwin Barnhard, and you've probably been listening to Earth Ancients and hearing what he is all about. He's a Mayanist in every sense of the word. What a pedigree he has working with Linda Shealy. Linda Shealy is one of the foremost Mayanists, and she's written a number of books. She passed away a few years ago, and I have mentioned her because although she is, you know, she's an Orthodox archaeologist, she was an artist, and she saw the Maya as an artist, and she interpreted their work in a different vein and much more open and free spirited, and I appreciate her writing. I appreciate her work. And Ed's directly associated with her because he was one of her students, but also a research investigator like her. And so Ed is our host on this tour. It's the ancient Maya of Tabasco and Chiapas. It's November 10th through the 17th of this year. And if you've ever wanted to do a fun tour, come out and join us. It's very reasonably priced. We're going to head first to Villahermosa, Mexico, to go to the land of the Olmec. And we'll go to La Venta, which is noted not only for its amazing sculptures, but also for whatever few ruins we have from the Olmec. That's a very old place. And then there's another indoor museum that's quite fun to look at, too. So we start there, and then the next day we get on a bus and we drive a few miles to Chiapas, and we go to Palenque. And I've been wanting to go to Palenque for many, many years. And if you've been listening to Earth Ancients, Ed actually did one of the most comprehensive surveys of that city. And we're going to hear in his own words what he discovered, as well as seeing and experiencing the temples, the pyramids, and the buildings, including the massive palace that is on that location. So that's just 1 or 2 days. We'll be spending 7 days in Chiapas and looking at some other sites. Very new to me, but he has selected some locations that are rich with history, but also with the tapestry, with the wonderful engineering and pyramids of the ancient Maya. For more information, come out and join us. Go to earthancients.com/tours. We're only about halfway full, but I want to remind people now, if you're planning a vacation, consider coming out with Earth Ancients Tours. We're all about the experience, and so the tours are experiential. In other words, you're not sitting and looking at pyramids. You're climbing pyramids. You're walking in and through temples. I'll have a meter with me so we can measure whatever electromagnetic or geomagnetic energy is flowing through these buildings. And in places where we really get a good reading, we'll sit and do a little meditation. If you're not into meditation, all you got to do is close your eyes and you are transformed. And I laugh a little bit because some people I bring and they're like, I've never experienced this before, but I'll tell you, it's wonderful. It's wonderful to do. earthancients.com/tours. Hey, I might have mentioned that we are a sponsor of probably the largest and best program for ancient civilizations, off-world types, new science and wisdom. It's called Contact in the Desert. It's happening June 2nd to the 4th in the Palm Desert. You got to fly into Palm Springs. It is an amazing tour. It's an amazing conference. It includes Graham Hancock, Linda Moulton Howe, about 70 unique speakers. And, A.V. Loeb's going to be there. It's going to be fun to hear what he has to say. Remember, he's going to be dredging the Pacific to find what is down there, the remains of what he figures is a probe. Just hearing him live would be very interesting. So consider this conference. For more information, go to contactinthedesert.com and consider attending. You know, if you're going to attend any conference, this is really the one to consider, because not only is the speaker lineup superb, but the grounds are very accessible. There is one section where all the authors kind of get together and they have their own little tables. You can have your book signed and have a minute to speak with the people who are there. I would do it just to come out and say hi to Graham. It's always fun to talk to him. He's very, very accessible. All these people are very accessible, very friendly and forward. And again, to get more information, go to contactinthedesert.com and you can register there. It's really reasonably priced. You can get a quick flight into Palm Desert. Some people fly into LAX and then rent a car and drive a couple hours to Palm Springs, Palm Desert. I'm in Northern California. I'll be driving down and we'll be interviewing. So, hey, if you're in the area, I'd love to speak with you. If you're at the conference, say hi and love to get an idea what's going on with you. So contactinthedesert.com and we'll see you there. Hey, we got a new t-shirt that just came out and it is designed by a well-known Indonesian artist. He's actually an illustrator who specializes in t-shirts. This new t-shirt's called the Lemurian Court. It features the king and queen of Lemuria. Rich, rich color. You can see it if you go to Earth Ancients on Facebook. You will see it there. Or you can go and find it and order it directly at earthancients.com under products. We have a whole products page there. This is really cool because it's coming up on springs. Weather's getting warmer and t-shirts are very comfortable when it gets warm. You can have a black t-shirt or a white t-shirt. There's a number of designs there, but this new Lemurian couple, the king and queen of Lemuria, is very, very cool. It looks really nice on a black t-shirt. And check it out, earthancients.com under products. And for the next couple of weeks, you can get a t-shirt for as low as $16. So check that out. All right. Hey, that's it for this program. I want to thank my guest today, Carl Abramson, coming to us from Sweden. As always, the team of Ruth Thomas, Mark Foster, and everyone else who makes this thing happen. You guys rock. Yeah, you do. All right. Take care. Be well. And we will talk to you next time. Thank you.